Welcome to another episode of Speed Change Repeat. I'm today at the Edge in Amsterdam, actually.
Epicenter.
Oh, Epicenter. Well, first mistake for the episode. I mean, that is a good start. I'm here today with Antti.
Yes.
Hi, Antti. Thanks for being on our show today.
No problem.
Can you please, we always start the same way. So we always ask our guests to, well, kind of give us a storytelling way on their life. Or let's say, at least a professional career. You don't have to start when you were a baby or when you were born.
Yeah.
But just go through, let's say, the most important stations in your, let's say, professional life. What really, let's say, shaped you and how you actually got to where you are today and why we are here in Amsterdam today. And what are you doing or what are you up to today?
Great. Actually, I do have to go a little bit further back. I think that I was born in Finland. And we moved abroad when I was in middle school to Brussels, and I went to International School of Brussels. After that, I went to Copenhagen International School. And I think that, you know, that had a lot of impact on me just to, you know, be part of the international community. And I think a lot of the network from there are still either friends or professional network that I use right now. And after I did my international baccalaureate in Copenhagen, I went to school in Boston. I went to Emerson College and I went to study media and entertainment management, I guess you could call. And this was in 96 that I went there. And it was really interesting throughout the course because we started studying about media and entertainment structures that had been there for the last 40 years. And in 98, Napster came, or 99. And I remember going to my senior year and my professor at the time said that, you know what, everything you've learned the last 2 years, forget about it. It's like this will change the distribution models of content. And I remember the first thing I saw on the internet that for me, I mean, obviously the internet had been around before, but nobody had realized that because of the connection speeds, etc., that, you know, it could be really used for content distribution. I think that Napster was one of the first ones that really, at least my generation affected, you know, in terms of, wow, you know, you can have this catalog of everything. And then you started thinking, well, you can have catalogs of everything, of everything. So, you know, I remember watching when Star Wars came back and did episode 1, 2, and 3, the first trailer. I mean, it took me half an hour to load. I mean, it was a tiny, tiny window that I watched it on. But that really had a big effect on me because then we started thinking, well, you know, newspapers will go online, video will go online. And, you know, obviously I was 21 at the time and we thought that newspapers would be dead within 10 years. I mean, I think we were wrong about it. I remember being on a panel, I think it was in 99, and there was four other people on the panel, and every one of them said that internet is a fad, that it's not going to change anything. It's going to be like a CD or, you know, the VHS or, you know, something like that. It was a media-related panel, and I was the young guy that's saying that you guys are all wrong. You know, there will be no more newspapers in 10 years. And we were actually both wrong about it because, you know, I think that the internet had a bigger effect than just putting content online. And I was wrong because now if you look at today, you know, the media mix that people use, newspapers are still around. After that, I went to work for a company called BroadcastDVD.com in Los Angeles. That was a Disney-backed kind of a dot-com startup, whatever, and we went down with the rest of the dot-coms. We did DVDs when nobody had DVD players. There was no DVD players and computers at the time. And we did rich media productions on DVDs. So like, you know, Rolling Stone magazine on DVD, or, you know, we had some of our own IP and the content was great and we had a ton of funding, but then funding ended, you know, quite quickly. And then after that, I moved to London to go work for Accenture. It was Anderson Consulting at the time, in their communications and high-tech department that had just been set up. Enron had literally just happened. Anderson had the split between the accounting and the consulting, and then it became Accenture. I think it became like 2 months either before or after I started. And there, you know, we worked a lot in the media and entertainment department. And you know, built these digital asset management systems for corporations, because somebody like BBC, I mean, you know, it was all like offline editing still at the time, and online editing was just starting. And it was a great learning curve those 3 years for me to really kind of see how much technology is required behind it, because before I had just kind of looked at it from a consumer point of view. After Accenture, we set up our own consulting company. We did 2.5G video. That was our thing. So like 30-second clips. We had some of our own companies. We had Vibe Media, where we worked with Chris Romano, for example. That was a writer from South Park doing these little 30-second animations. And we were basically looking for content that could be kind of chewed up in 30 seconds with this Nokia 6610, I think it was called. And at the same time, we were consulting a lot. So we worked with British Telecom on BT Movio, which was the first mobile TV company. It was on DAB network. So the where the battery is, there was this like 2-centimeter deep receptor for the DAB network. Digital audio broadcast network. So the GSM network, or the, like 3G was just coming. So that wasn't fast enough. We worked with, Virgin Media. That was kind of the first content led operator in London, and also did Quad Play. And also I had the pleasure of working with Sanctuary Records Group, because at this time you have to remember that record labels were still fighting against this change. I mean, I went to work for Sanctuary Records Group, which at the time was the largest global independent record label and management company in the world. And not all the content was digitized yet. And, you know, iTunes was there. Everybody was like, is iTunes a threat or not? The CD sales were, I mean, they had just kind of hit their peak, and they were starting to come down, and things like the MySpace had just come. So like things like digital marketing was just coming there, and I had the pleasure of working with the great catalog artists, as well as new releases from guys like Morrissey and Idlewild, Iron Maiden, and that's when we kind of first started talking about, well, wouldn't it be great to know who your fans are and how much they spend? And we did some analysis on some of the artists' fan bases, and we realized that 1% of the fans spend, you know, bring 90% of the revenue. So that's when all these kind of special boxes started coming out, the Trojan Records re-releases of, you know, more expensive product for that 1%. We did some great digital campaigns where Morrissey, I think he had his third single coming out, and at the Virgin Festival that he was headlining, we did a campaign where you could order the single when he actually performed it, and you would get the live version that was performed as well as the kind of the recorded version. And but that was good, you know, like really kind of like the wild west of digital, because I mean, still record labels worked on catalog numbers, and catalog numbers were CDs, and tracks, individual tracks did not have catalog numbers. So how would we account individual track sales on iTunes or on, you know, any of the other kind of services back to the artist? And it was an accounting nightmare. It was a mindset nightmare. But then at the same time, you know, it provided a ton of opportunity for artists that were really forward thinking. Universal Records bought Sanctuary, and we had to kind of divest one of the startups, and the band that I was managing at the time broke up. So I basically was out of a project for the first time. So I decided to go back to Finland for the first time in 20 years. And I did something completely different. I worked with kind of special needs kids for a year, which was great. It was kind of a sabbatical, and it was really interesting to come back because, you know, because of Nokia, Finland was really thought to be the kind of the thought leader in digital and digital services and mobile technology. And engineering-wise, it really was. I mean, it was some of the best engineering in the world, but you know, coming back from London to Finland, and, you know, IPTV, for example, still hadn't come around. People still were like, you know, do we need a website? Like, that, it's not that far away. People are like, do we need a website? And it was kind of forward thinking that we did. I went to work for a company called Avaus Consulting. That was a kind of a digital consulting company that I became a partner of shortly after that. And, you know, we were really going with digital business agenda. And a lot of the corporates still saw digital as a marketing function. So at Avaus Consulting, for example, hockey is big in Finland. So in 2009, we worked with, I think it was 2009, 2010, we did the first kind of live streams of hockey games in Finland. And I remember because we were talking to our network provider at the time, and they asked, well, how much capacity will you guys need? And I can't remember what the number was, so I'm not going to lie. And we said this, and they just started laughing. They were like, that's not like even feasible that many people would, you know, concurrently watch a live hockey game online. And I remember the playoffs of, I think it was the second year the service was on, we were taking 1/3 of the national framework because of the bit sizes, because obviously we had an old friend of mine, a really great guy that was kind of, you know, we're working with the digital product. And, you know, he was like, we wanted to be like as good quality as possible. Because the thing is that Finland has great infrastructure. So people had, I think that we were one of the first countries with kind of fiber optic broadband. So people had this capacity that they weren't using. So once we came out with a service that they could use, I mean, obviously they would, you know, watch the games in high quality because the hockey puck is small. And it was so funny because neither me or him knew nothing about hockey. So we would be like, how many periods are in a hockey game? You know, talking with the National League. And because we had to calculate in our head, well, how many bits are going to be required for it? And we also worked with HBO. We brought HBO Go to the Nordics. HBO kind of, it was their first digital product that wasn't tied to the cable product. And they thought that Scandinavia would be far enough to try it out so the operators, the telco operators in the States wouldn't like hear about it. But it was funny because Netflix was coming on at the same time. So it actually became this really big thing that HBO is trying out this new thing and Netflix is going to compete and who's going to come out first. And I worked a lot with the IPTV, et cetera. But then the last 2 years that I worked with Avaus Consulting, at this time, we had grown the company from about 15 people to, I think, about 100. I kind of realized that the digital transformation is now starting to happen in other industries. And I had the pleasure of working with a great, great elevator company where we... SAP isn't the most user-friendly software in the world, where we built kind of tablet solutions on top of SAP that became usable. And you could then tell that, okay. And then also there was two things that happened. First of all, I realized that, you know, the kind of the B2B market's going to be really big for digital as well. And there's going to be a lot of things that will happen. And the second thing that I realized was that the kind of the consulting model of, you know, do a strategy for 6 months, then design something for 6 months, and then build something for a year. It's too slow of a process. Because by the time we came up with our kind of, you know, the tablet applications, you know, things like Google Maps integrations in terms of traffic management, there's so many things that were happening with the intelligence behind it that we couldn't, you know, keep up with the change, and definitely our customers couldn't keep up with the change. So Avaus Consulting was then bought in 2014 by a company called Sealy Solutions, which is a kind of a bigger company. And actually, Avaus Consulting was split to the marketing innovations that's still around. And then the technology and the consulting department was bought by Sealy Solutions. And I basically left. And then I kind of did a lot of research on, because you could already then tell that the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Googles, the Microsofts, the Apples, I mean, like that, how do they keep up with innovation? Because looking at them in 2014 from the outside, you thought that, you know, everything they touched turned to gold. And at the same time, I had some friends that were working there from other networks, and I had this kind of, when you sell a company, you're not allowed to work for a competing company for 6 months. So we call it like an underwear consulting year, where you can't do anything structured. So I I didn't interview them, but I spoke with a lot of them and, you know, really trying to figure out, you know, how do they keep up with the change? And that's when I realized that, you know, for every hit, they have like 10,000 things that are not a hit. And the kind of the like the innovation funnel idea was just staggering. And the way they work with what's, I mean, corporate venturing is nothing new, but the way they worked with the corporate venturing tool shed of investing or working with startups and growth companies or acqui-hiring and mergers and acquisitions and accelerators and hackathons and all these things. I mean, you know, the, at least from what it felt like is that they have a very kind of a linear process for this, and they kind of they knew how to work with that, and they had, you know, hundreds of people working with that. And then at the same time, I would look at more traditional companies, and when I say more traditional companies, companies that have been around for more than 20 years, and they were still trying to innovate everything themselves. And they were trying to kind of, you know, build things, you know, the, you know, massive R&D departments and, you know, huge kind of, you know, the trying to keep up with the change. And that's when I realized that, you know, this need for like a corporate venturing advisory. And at the same time, some of my ex-colleagues were setting up Avanta Ventures already. And I then joined them. And that's why we set up Avanta Ventures in Finland. And we started from kind of hackathons, organizing, I mean, innovation challenges, we called them, and we learned so much from the whole process of, you know, the corporations with their rigid structures, it's really difficult for them to even be able to onboard some of those innovations. And we realized that, you know, unless you're a very structured corporate venture capital kind of with the corporate venture capital department, that, you know, to invest is actually not a good thing for the startup or for the corporate. We realized that a lot of the accelerators are very important for the ecosystem, but for different reasons than what we thought. I mean, they, a lot of the, you know, I know I'm generalizing here, but accelerators are really about internal labs. I mean, they're really about culture change rather than change, you know, building new 100, 200 million euro businesses, which at the end of the day, you know, any corporation that, you know, has turnover over a billion, I mean, that's the kind of the goal that they should have. We built a few startups ourselves as well. We did some investing, but then, you know, I think that right now we have kind of found after 4 years the, you know, who we really are. And then the last 2 years, this kind of the business ecosystem idea started coming along. And again, there was a lot of reports done on why Europe hasn't stayed with the change, with the innovation, and the reasons were that there's not these kind of vertical ecosystems. And there's a lot of great startup ecosystems now in Europe, kind of citywide, but I feel that there's a stronger need for kind of vertical, whether it's life sciences or mobility, that I'm sure we'll talk about a lot more. Things like that, where, you know, it brings in where corporations work together on these kind of macro changes that they're facing. And there's been so many studies that it really is one of the reasons why Europe hasn't been able to keep up. And I think that there's a strong vertical ecosystem push right now within Europe. And we run two. We're setting up a third one. So one is the maritime innovation in the city of Turku, with some great customers like Royal Caribbean and Meyer and Wärtsilä was involved as well. We'll run Loop Ventures, which is around kind of a digital ecosystem where we accelerate circular economy ventures for our customers. And the latest and the biggest and the most ambitious one is this Mobility City Campus that we are currently in the process of setting up in the city of Rotterdam.
Yeah, that is a lot to take in. There's a lot of interesting moments in your life, definitely. I find one sentence that you just pulled like a couple of minutes ago, which is corporate innovation centers, or let's say innovation hubs or labs or whatever you call them. And I mean, every major corporation on this planet has one.
Yep.
Right? If you look at Europe, let's say the biggest brands that we know, you name them, all have, let's say, either, what are the cities? Yeah, Berlin, most probably. Mm-hmm. A lot of labs are in Berlin. Well, some are in London. You have Amsterdam. And, you know, it's actually interesting. You said that those are not for, let's say, building 200 million euro businesses or $1 billion businesses or whatever, but rather, let's say, to foster or, let's say, accelerate cultural change.
Yeah.
And I couldn't agree more because, you know, there's... I actually read an article not long ago where it was about, like, okay, why most corporate, let's say, innovation labs or whatever, or accelerators fail or are not able to, let's say, to meet the goal, which is building new businesses.
But it's the wrong KPI. I wouldn't say that most of those have failed. I think that they've actually had a lot of good that has come out of it,
yeah.
But it's just because they have been set up with the wrong KPI.
Yeah. You know what's interesting then? Okay, what is then the KPI that you would measure on?
I would measure on kind of learning new ways of building things, you know, everything like design thinking, you know, like that.
How would you measure then? Because, like, if it's culture, because I agree, I 100% agree that let's say it's about changing culture, and which is, if you think about it, quite an expensive, or let's say quite an expense, right?
Yeah.
To learn how to, or let's say to change culture.
Yeah.
Right? Even though, let's say, changing culture is the hardest thing.
Yeah.
Right? It's not learning about, like, methods, you know, like,
yeah.
like different methods that have sprung out somewhere out of a startup in Silicon Valley, you know,
yeah.
like you whatever method that is, you know,
yeah,
there's
yeah.
like one every year, there's a new one.
Yeah.
Best example, you know, it's like those like OKR methods or whatever, you know, like
yeah.
Or design sprints or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's not about learning those methods. It's actually changing the way of thinking
yeah.
of the people that are, let's say, work for your company.
I think one of the major things is, you know, understanding failure.
Yeah.
You know, and being able to withstand failure. And I think that that's, you know, if you look at... I don't think that Facebook looks at, like, every investment that they've made that hasn't worked out as a failure. So, you know, Facebook still invests into companies, minority invests, acquires, you know, and I think that that's exactly the change, because they understand that, you know, that they learn from every one of those failures something. Whereas in the corporate world, you know, like you said, I have a friend of mine that runs a very big CVC company. And I remember meeting him about 3 years ago, and they had a big American customer. And when they had set up their CVC function, for half a year before that, they would said, look, you know, you have to understand the math of VCs, right? You know, like 70% fail, you know, 20% bring the money back, 3% you have like 2x, and they all, yeah. First bad investment, he was flown to the boardroom and they were like, what is this?
Yeah.
And he was like, well, look, you know, this is exactly the thing. It's not an exact math. Innovation isn't an exact procedure.
But then again, you know, I think, or let's talk about this, because, okay, let's say taking a traditional company that has been existing for, let's say, 20 years, 30 mm-hmm. years, whatever, that has, where the way they make money today is not sustainable for the future.
Yeah.
Let's just take this as an example. But still, I mean, the operations and the processes of today and the way they make money today is important to keep the business alive, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that has to run.
Yeah.
The difficulty, I guess, and that's why you need this playground, right? Because you cannot innovate on that, let's say, on that same turf.
Yeah.
You can't innovate on that turf where people... literally make money, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing with, let's say, you know, manufacturing companies or companies nowadays that are building physical things,
mm-hmm.
you know? Take a car company or whatever. People that are working within these fields, you know, either in manufacturing or whatever, who are, let's say, closer to the physical product, right?
Mm-hmm.
They always say, yeah, well, you know, we are the ones that are making the money.
Yeah.
And those innovation guys,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
those
yeah.
digital guys
yeah.
are the ones that are spending the money.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, then, and I think... the difficulty then is, okay, how do you make that switch then?
Yeah.
Because if you say, in an incubator or like in an innovation lab, you're not like, it's not about building the next business. But then again, that's what you need to do ultimately, mm-hmm. right? If the one that is, let's say if the value proposition that you have today is on demise and mm-hmm. that's not how you're going to earn money at one point, if you want to keep your brand alive, right?
Yeah.
You need to have that switch
yeah.
where you go from, okay, now that one is slowly going down,
mm-hmm.
revenue is declining, but we have, you know, we have these new business, let's say new value propositions, yep. new ways of making money.
Yeah.
Do you have
Yeah, no, I do. In my opinion, if you're a company that has turnover over 1 billion euros, you do all these functions. You do hackathons, you do innovation challenges, you have your own lab, internal lab, external lab, you have a CVC function, you have a very active M&A function, and you kind of, you know, look at, let's say that you spend on R&D, you spend 150, 200 million a year, you take 1/3 of that and you put it into these functions. And you put the KPIs within those functions in the sense that people understand that, you know, the hackathons are not going to build the next 200 million businesses. But this might be a public story, so I can, you know, go about it. It's the way Disney found, I can't remember which Star Wars movie it was, but they had that ball robot. You know, the way they found it. Do you know the story?
No, I don't. You mean the new one with the, like,
yeah, what was it called? That
I don't know. I only know the old ones because, like, I watch the new ones, but I'm not a big fan of the new ones. I really like the
anyway. So in this knit that I think it was the kind of the first one of the last three that came out. They have this robot that's a ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And at a Disney accelerator or a hackathon or something like that, you know, in Colorado, I think it could have been a Techstars program, I don't know, there was this robotics company, a startup, that had this ball, right, that was moving around. And nobody could figure out what to do with that ball. And you got to remember, Disney Studios is like in Los Angeles and very separate, and a Disney hackathon is happening somewhere else. And whoever was organizing the hackathon then went to the director and said that, hey, you know, you had that idea for this robot thing. Like, I think that those guys might have something for it. And long story short, 12 months later, you know, the movie comes out. There's that robot toy, and they're using this startup's IP and innovation for the toy that was being sold in all the shops. And I can't remember how many tens of millions or 100 millions they made on that toy. But I think that's a very good example that if Disney didn't have all these different activities going on around, they would never have found that. And it's a volume game. And, you know, like, you need to spend, I would say, 10 times more than what you're spending right now. I mean, like if I was the CEO of, like, a 5 billion company or something like that, I'd try to figure out how much does Google, for example, spend on these activities. And then I would take that percentage and put that into my business and say that we need to put the same percentage into investments, into innovation. Because I think that you're completely right. I mean, well, first of all, I don't know if you're aware of the kind of the horizon thinking, where horizon one is your current business, horizon two is your growth business, horizon three is future business. And when I think it was McKinsey or Harvard that came with this horizon thinking, I think it was in the end of 90s, you know, you would always look at horizon one is like the next year or the next 2 years. And horizon two is like 3 to 5 years. And horizon three, which is, you know, future business, that's in 10 years. Because of the exponential change of the technology, horizon three has come so much closer. Where, you know, the future business that you really don't know what your business is, that could be in 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
When before, that was in like 10 years. So you could, you know, do some white papers or work with universities or, you know, to kind of look at that. And obviously, there's still technologies that are 10 years away, like quantum, you know, computing. But then I look at the quantum lab in Delft and I look at what the stuff that they're doing there already. And I'm like, well, 10 years, maybe that's in 5 years. Because if you look at... there's the IBM example, but we had a chance to at a event that was organized by Startup Delta here in the Netherlands. There were some of the people from the quantum computing, and we asked that, when are you going to have a quantum computer at home? And they said, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20, 30 years, can't say that answer. But then if you would have asked, you know, when the Nokia 6610 came, that when are you going to have processing power like we have today in the, you know, cell phone 10 years ago, people would have said maybe like 20, 30 years. Like, you know what
I mean?
Yeah,
exactly.
The pace of the change is just so fast. And, you know, a lot of people that are smarter than me say that, you know, AI and machine learning and everything like that is going to even increase that pace.
Yeah.
So that's why I think that corporations are, I personally think that the digital transformation journey has literally like just begun.
Yeah.
Like we are at the tip of the iceberg. And like really structural changes are going to start now happening.
Yeah.
Where I can't remember, I think it was Anderson Horowitz had this fabulous presentation online where they said that, you know, 2% of the global GDP right now is digital, where 98% is still left. And that's why, you know, these changes are just going to happen a lot quicker, which again, from a kind of a European standpoint, you know, it forces corporates and for the corporates to start working together, you know, with the, you know, in a better way with startups and growth companies, and, you know, because you can't really do them yourselves. I mean, if you look at just Google's ecosystem and all the places they get innovation from, it's just staggering.
Yeah, you know, it's actually an interesting thought, and I will go back and look on some of the numbers if they're public to, let's say, big corporations on what their R&D spendings are today, because what I believe is, you know, let's say, okay, let's differentiate between privately owned company and let's say one that is stock listed.
Mm-hmm.
What I think the major issue is what you said, okay, in order to, let's say, to really look, or let's say, be future proof and look at these horizon levels, right? Or work with these with that view, basically, you need to spend money.
Yeah.
Right?
That
is the way.
Free.
You know, and what I think is, that, you know, because it always is, and in business, it's always about growth.
Yeah.
You know, it's always about, okay. And if you look at on traditional companies, and fortunate enough, we all have been that. Well, the global economy has been doing very well the past decade,
mm-hmm.
very, very well. There's growth everywhere.
Yeah.
Everyone is making good money, and revenue is growing and growing mm-hmm. and growing. And it's basically, every time, like every year, it's the same thing. You know, the goal is to increase that revenue for next year. So that
also that has something to do with the price of money,
the price, okay,
and interest rates. Why, you know, this growth has been able to be sustained. Whether that's sustainable or not, you know, that remains to be
exactly.
seen.
Exactly. But to be honest, then if we would take that approach that you're saying, that would mean that companies actually, in order to, let's say, and if you say we're at the tip of digital transformation, in order to, let's say, really be future-proof, they actually need to take into account that they might need to step a little bit back, you know, and not have that crazy, let's say, growth after growth, and maybe even, let's say, take into account a decrease in revenue.
Yeah.
But in order, let's say, to have more money available for let's say, for these, let's say, more future-proof studies.
And I think that, like, if, you know, especially when it comes to sustainability, and if I was a big energy company right now, I would say that, you know, for my shareholders, that we're not going to make any profit in the next 10 years. We're going to spend all of that on sustainable energy forms. And there actually is a energy company CEO that I know for a fact, I can't name him, that said this to their board members that, hey, look, you know, if we want to be around in 100 years' time, this is the time that we need to invest in these sustainable energy formats. And like, because, you know, I would say that if you're a company that's been around for, you know, 50 years, you want to be around for another 50 years. And I think that with sustainability and energy, there's going to be a lot of new players that are going to come into the market. You can already see it kind of bubbling under. And I would take one of those could be the Google of energy or the Facebook of energy.
Yeah.
And if you look at the kind of the media, you know, media landscape 15 years ago versus now, or, you know, just the retail landscape 15 years and now, the way people communicate, you know, telco, like you pretty much, you know, any of those assets that have been easy to digitalize, I think all those things will come in the sense which are more difficult to digitalize through blockchain, through AI, through things like solar. And I would not sleep well at night if I wasn't spending, you know, a ton of the revenue that I'm currently making on making sure that we're not around for another 50 years.
But then that would actually, you know, I guess if you're a stock-listed company, that is like way harder.
Oh, 100%.
You know, like, yeah. I mean, how the fuck do you communicate that to your shareholders, right?
Well, I mean, do you want to get like 12% dividends for the next 5 years, or yeah. do you want to get 12% dividend, like, you know, the zero dividends for the next 10 years and then get 20% for the next 100 years? You know what I mean? That's how you communicate, because I don't think that these problems are going to be easy to solve.
No.
And I think that, you know, a lot of with things like energy infrastructure and, you know, things like mobility as well, I think that there's a lot of, before, you know, that the building of a car was such a capital intensive operation that you couldn't be a startup, that, you know, a car is startup. You didn't see those for a very long time. And now I think that through 3D printing and all the innovation that are happening within the car industry, I mean, there's Lightyear here in the Netherlands, there's Byton in Germany, in Canada, we just met some representatives yesterday, there's like five of these kind of car startups that are really, you know, believable because the production costs have become so much lower. And I think that Tesla has been an interesting kind of a thought leader on that, hey, you can take this old industry and change it. And yeah. I think nobody took Tesla seriously, and I'm pretty sure they take it now.
Yeah, that is true. I want to go, let's say, into more detail, if you can, give mm-hmm. an example, because you say, okay, with your company, you are, let's say, a corporate venture capital firm.
Or let's say we are a corporate venturing advisory.
Corporate venturing advisory,
so we don't. We very rarely talk more our customers out of investing than into investing, because there's a lot of better formats to work with the growth company.
All right. Could you give an example that you could, let's say, talk about with a success story, or let's say with a big company that you work with and that you basically helped?
Yeah. I think that these are going to be kind of Finnish examples because of our Dutch operations are still quite new, and this ecosystem in Rotterdam has taken a lot of the time. But I mean, we just launched last week a new service for a Finnish operator called DNA that basically is owned by Telenor, a Norwegian operator, and it basically makes it easier to regulate your heat within your apartments. So you save basically 30% out of the energy. And the way we did it is that you know, we screened a lot of the landscape of you know, the startups and everything that's happening in that field. We came up with kind of venture building concepts of what it could look like. We teamed up with a startup that we built this service on top of, and now we launched last week in Finland. And I think that that's exactly the, when people are saying, you know, whether it's venture, should we do venture building, or should we build an accelerator, or should we analyze the kind of the startup landscape? You have to do all of them, because most likely those new 100 million euro businesses that you're after will be a combination of the different activities, and taking a venture building idea, connecting it with, you know, a startup's technology, you know, using maybe another company to help with the growth hacking or the partner models. And it's not going to be like, hey, we got this idea from this one accelerator and we found the guys to do it. That's just pumped and, you know, filled with money. And then, you know, that there will be this new 100 million euro business. That's not how it works. It's going to be a combination of all and learnings from all those processes.
That is a really interesting thought, and I think that is a perfect point to, let's say, go across to the concept that you're working on, let's say, in Rotterdam.
Yes,
the mobility concept, where and you have before we started the podcast, you already kind of give me an insight on, let's say, your view in terms of, let's say, networks,
mm-hmm.
And the importance of them, especially for Europe. And I think it would be great if you could elaborate on, let's say, the project in Rotterdam and why it is crucial or why it is important.
Yeah, and it's crucial on a few different levels. I mean, so basically, I met a gentleman called Kevin Nikio. I think it was a little bit more than a year ago, and he had been advising some of the big automakers of Germany on innovation and marketing and things like that. And he had gotten this idea from them to build a city within a city where a lot of this innovation, you know, regarding mobility could happen. Because I think that even they, you know, were quite out front about, you know, how they are falling behind in this innovation, how to structure it. And so he came to us and, you know, we had already kind of structured some of these ecosystems and make them into kind of doable projects, I guess you could say. So we came up with this, that we need to do a feasibility study first, and we need to find a city that would be interested in being part of this. Obviously, you know, also being part of the budget of the feasibility study. And so we had a vision. And we had a project that we wanted to do, and then we went and visited a bunch of cities, and everybody was interested, but nobody had the kind of a burning platform, or, you know, nobody had the kind of urgency that, yes, this is something that we want. And we met with the city of Rotterdam then. We have a gentleman called Oad Gilad, that's the founder of Keeden Ventures, for example. He owns 42 Workspace, very active in the city of Rotterdam. I met him at Slush almost 2 years ago, and he said that, wait, this could be something that's interesting for Rotterdam. We met with Julia from Rotterdam Partners, and they basically got all the deciders in one room that should be involved in this project if it happens. This was end of October, beginning of November last year. And Kevin at the time was involved in organizing the mobility track at Slush. I can't remember if it was an official track or whether it was a side event, but a very large mobility kind of event at Slush. Slush is a big technology conference in Finland. And we told them that we were like, look, you know, either we're going to launch at the mobility track saying we're looking for the city to host this, or we're going to launch that we're going to do it with Rotterdam. And they, in 3 weeks, made the decision, which for a city is fast, like really fast. I've worked with a lot of cities in my career. And they made the decision that, yeah, they want to be involved and let's start doing this feasibility study. The media interest right away was like staggering. I mean, like, literally it was like, you know, we had this campus already and we were like, you know, some of the city officials were like, yeah, you know, you can't really talk about this on social media so much yet. And actually, it wasn't even us. It was the city talking about it on social media. So we already got a ton of interest. And with the feasibility study, and when we talk about mobility, we really talk about land, air, and sea. A lot of people would like to bring space into it as well, and I would like to as well. But at the same time, that's not something that we have any concrete things going on right now. And during the feasibility study, we interviewed, I think it was like 100 different stakeholders, from large European corporations to a lot of the local ecosystem in Rotterdam as well. And we wanted to answer two questions. One was that, you know, is the European mobility industry interested in this kind of a physical ecosystem? And when I say interested, I mean, are they willing to invest into it? And the second question was that, is Rotterdam the right place for it in terms of physical location? Because we're talking, you know, 10 to 12 hectares of land. We want it to be a real physical campus with a consumer experience center where consumers can come and try out these, you know, future innovations like flying cars or Hyperloop, or see, you know, cargo being offloaded robotically and moved around. And, you know, so we really wanted to have the kind of a consumer focus. And with I was very surprised, because mobility is not something that I have really, you know, as a vertical, concentrated on a lot. We had a few mobility initiatives in Finland. One of them would have been one success story for the corporate venturing. But that wasn't something that I was doing. And I was surprised by how open the corporates of the European mobility industry said that, you know, yes, we are falling behind in innovation. And yes, this kind of neutral location, because anything innovative that happens within the corporate headquarters, even though they want to say it's open innovation, it still gets, kind of branded by
its homegrown.
It's homegrown. And Rotterdam, because of its location, 20 minutes from Schiphol, the biggest port in Europe, the kind of the can-do attitude, like everybody was like, yeah, Rotterdam's a great place for it. And yes, you know, we need something like this. And there was a lot of kind of details what they needed. One was that, you know, it really needs to be Horizon 3 future business oriented. The second one was that there needs to be a lot of testing and piloting areas. I was really surprised by how few testing and piloting, open testing and piloting areas there are in Europe for things like urban air mobility or level 5 autonomous cars. And like that was shocking to me, because I would say that, well, if you can't test and pilot these things, how can you really, you know, build something or figure out whether you're building something that's good? And so then in April, we and also there was the there's perfect places for it within the city of Rotterdam. Those that don't know, Rotterdam is really a port city, and the port is moving further away to the sea, which is freeing up a lot of real estate that's by the water. And the first one that they really developed is the RDM, which has already been a great success. And so we're hoping to develop it somewhere around that area as well. And we do have a perfect location in mind, but it still needs a little bit of work to get the kind of approvals from the city and the port. And so we launched in April. Then at the next web, which is the conference in Amsterdam, we got approval in April from the City Council of Rotterdam to move forwards. We launched it in May at the next web, and the interest that we got was just staggering. I mean, not just only from the corporations that we had interviewed for this feasibility study, but also I think that we had something like 350 companies, you know, from growth companies to larger corporations to media companies that said, hey, we want to get involved. So our consultants are very good at building really pretty roadmaps. So our roadmap was basically blown to shit, because, you know, we had really kind of thought that we were going to have this really nice and comfortable phased approach to it. But because the interest is so high, to keep the momentum going, I think that the real estate requirements, you know, increased by quite a lot very quickly. And so right now we're at the point where we are looking to really commit the corporates to get involved. We're working with the Port of Rotterdam's project group on making the spatial plans for the campus. We are, and all this is going to happen in the next couple of months. We are busy setting up some of the first innovation programs that will already start this fall. They're probably going to be more local oriented, either with the port or with RET, which is the public transportation operator. And then come next year, we're hoping to start setting up these, either whether it's an R&D center for battery technology or for hydrogen and maritime, or how port will work with the data and external like port API projects and all these things. And, you know, we're in the very beginning of a very long journey, and we're hoping to have by 2022 this campus fully up and running with the full consumer center, all this open innovation happening with different themes. Hyperloop is another very theme that we're interested in. Hard Hyperloop, which is from Delft, I would say is one of the leading Hyperloop companies in Europe. They have their test track right now, which they test the actual technology, and they're looking at the full speed test track. And we're also looking to do the consumer, the Hyperloop consumer experience design within the Mobility City campus. Because if you think that once Hyperloop will be reality, whether it's in 10 years or 15 years, you have to think everything from ticketing to luggage handling to, you know, to everything completely in a new way, because it allows you to do it that same way. Just like, you know, Tesla has thought, you know, what a car is in a completely the new way, and driving a car, and, you know, the apps that are involved in the car, etc. So there's a lot of interesting verticals. We're still in the very beginning. We're hoping to have the real estate agreed upon within the next kind of 6 months. And yeah, then we're flying.
That is so interesting.
It really is.
That is so interesting. That is so crazy. Because also, just because I consider Rotterdam to be my second home.
Yeah.
I really love that city. And, you know, actually, when I heard about it the first time, you know, when I
how did you hear about it?
Man, that was either I randomly found it online, or I found out about it through Kaivon.
Okay.
So yeah. The thing is, when I read about it, it was like it makes so much sense.
Yeah.
For Rotterdam to be the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think Rotterdam actually is one of the most undervalued cities.
100%.
And one of the, let's say, to be honest, in my opinion, Rotterdam is that one city in Europe that we have, which is totally ignored with like the highest potential.
Yeah.
It is so great.
And I think it's so funny because, you know, I had never lived in Netherlands before I moved here and, you know, been working the last 2 years. And my vision of Rotterdam before I went to visit it was so completely wrong. You know, I thought it was this like gritty port city. Like you would never think, like I would never think of architecture on Rotterdam, for example. And the innovation capabilities. But I also think that they have a certain burning platform in terms that they've always been a port city. And port has been the economic backbone of the city. And as the port, now that their vision is to become the smartest port in the world. And unfortunately, being the smartest port in the world usually means that there's the least amount of people that work in the port. Do you see what I mean? And that's why I think that Rotterdam right now is in this kind of, I think it's a beautiful opportunity to really almost rethink yourself, you know, use the strengths and that they have. And there's such a kind of amazing feeling with the people from Rotterdam and like the Rotterdam as a city. And like you said, I think it's, yeah, undervalued and, you know, most potential, I think. And then the people make it, because I think that the people are really, you know, they obviously they still have a lot of work to do, especially with marketing, for example, because I think that, well, they just won the Eurovision competition. I hope they will utilize that in the right way, you know, with marketing. And, but I also think that initiatives like the Mobility City Campus are completely going to rebrand Rotterdam to what it should be.
Definitely. I mean, if you look at the city, like if you compare Amsterdam to Rotterdam, for example, right? I mean, like coming from the history of Rotterdam, just because it has been completely destroyed in a Second World War, if you look at the city, it also makes so much sense for, let's say, such a concept with the mobility campus, is because the city is built modern.
Yeah.
In a modern way.
Yeah, yeah.
The infrastructure is built in a modern way. Yeah. And like if you think about mobility, right? Or let's say new mobility forms, right? Mm-hmm. And if, like, for the people that don't know Rotterdam, but let's say for us who know Rotterdam, that city has that infrastructure. Is complete, like it is built in a new way.
Yeah.
You know, it has the infrastructure.
Yeah.
And it is such a great place. You know, and then I'm actually thinking, what were the other cities mm-hmm. that you looked at, and what were the requirements that you, let's say, had in mind when thinking about the cities?
Speed.
That's the only
for us at that point, it was speed of deciding. And I think that the Mobility City Campus, I mean, I think that there should be, and there probably will be, a lot of these vertical ecosystems being built around Europe, whether it's Milan and fashion tech and, you know, London and fintech, etc. And that they need this kind of physical location for it. But I also think that, you know, like first tier cities, you know, they don't really need these more attention, because like Amsterdam is full.
It's completely full.
Everybody that, you know, is thinking about coming to Europe or the Netherlands is like Amsterdam. Yeah. And I think it's fantastic, because I think, again, if I would have looked at innovation cities and ecosystems 10 years ago, I would have never thought Amsterdam as something that I want to move into to do this. And they've built this in, you know, 10 years, and I think really like in the last 5 years. But I think that it's the second tier cities that make it really interesting, that, you know, because they sometimes have space, they make it a little bit more, usually decision making processes are a little bit faster. I think that, you know, the city's involvement and that they have to be fast and, you know, make decisions, because I think that, you know, we've already hit, you know, some obstacles and have gone over them, but, you know, there will be some in the future as well. And I think that Rotterdam is the perfect place for it. And it was great how the European mobility industry really embraced the idea of having it in Rotterdam.
You know, and I think coming back to, let's say, what we try to focus on in this podcast, you know, what I explained to you beforehand, that we, try to, or let's say that we believe that, let's say, the biggest challenges within decades to come for humanity are around artificial intelligence mm-hmm. and sustainability. And
challenges or opportunities?
Both.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
Challenges also mean opportunities, right?
Yeah.
Solve a big challenge,
yeah,
there's great opportunity,
yeah,
right? So that's where you, before we started the podcast, also, intervened and said, this is like something like this mobility campus, you know, is so much supporting.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, like, it's like, we don't even talk about Mobility City Campus as a sustainability project. Obviously, new energy formats is going to be a very big theme of it. But if you look at, you know, and again, I can't remember what the exact figures are, but, you know, Hyperloop, you know, the requirements of energy versus the traditional modes that we have right now. I mean, I think it's like 10-20% of modes like that. If you have self-driving cars, the amount that they will use in terms of energy and things like braking and accelerating, and, you know, the things that, you know, I like to brake quickly and I like to accelerate fast when I'm driving my combustion engine or, you know, an electric car. So I think that all innovation that happens, whether it's with maritime and the port or everything has to do with how could we, people are moving in the cities in a kind of increasing pace. So how can we make cities more efficient, which also means more sustainable, which also means new ways of mobility? And I think that AI is going to have a huge, because I think that there are, you know, so many different data points to make these technologies real. I mean, if you think of sending a, you know, train, you know, in a vacuum tube, 1,000 kilometers an hour. I mean, I think that it's just safety around that are going to have so many AI components and the kind of the timetables. I think that everything is going to have so many AI components. But again, I wouldn't say this is an AI project. It's not a sustainability project. But in order for the Mobility City Campus to really produce the innovations, everything will be sustainable. Just de facto, and it's going to require a lot of the, not just AI, but also robotics and blockchain in terms of technologies to really enable these innovations.
Yeah, perfect. We're almost running out of time, and which is unfortunate because that is a really interesting conversation that we're having right now. But we have one last question mm-hmm. that we always... So, actually, the beginning of our podcasts are always the same, and the ending is also always the same.
Okay.
So, usually Benjamin is asking that question, but as he's not with us today, it's on me. And so, we basically believe that the people that are kind of, let's say, shaping the future, you know, or let's say are, building the future, mm-hmm. are also, to some degree, also the ones that are able to, let's say, predict it to some degree, you know? Of course not, they're not in, you know, like a place to come to ask them, okay, what is going to be the future? Mm-hmm. But they, you know, they have opinions
yeah.
on what will happen or what might happen in their opinion. And that is what we would like to hear from you, you know? We would like to, I would like to ask you now to, tell us as a final statement, something that will happen in the future. A prediction from your side.
Yeah.
What do you think will happen within a given time frame of your choice?
Yeah. That's a tough question because there's so many things I would like to get. But I mean, one of my favorite technologies in within mobility and sustainability is the Hyperloop. The problems that I've had the privilege of following Hart Hyperloop now for the last 6 months because of this Mobility City Campus, and the problems that they are solving every day And like, I don't know what the average age there is, but probably 24, 25, something like that. And I mean, they're solving problems that, you know, if other people have not been able to solve elsewhere. And I think that the Hyperloop infrastructure is within 15 years going to completely change the way we travel and move things.
15 years.
1-5.
That is a good statement, a really interesting statement, one that we would like to finish off this episode.
Great.
Antti, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, guys. Bye-bye.